2 Corinthians 6:17 will be the first passage we need read. Who wants to head over there and be ready for that in a few minutes? 2 Corinthians 6, verse 17. Our volunteer?
Hallelujah.
All right, Terry. We have left off in Acts chapter 5. You may remember, if you were here last week, that we were talking about Gamaliel. The apostles were brought before the Sanhedrin, very likely some others, and that was sort of a testy meeting. The group wanted to slay the apostles. They were pretty much out of control. You have several members of the Sanhedrin there, and they were really, really unhappy. And there is this fellow who stands up by the name of Gamaliel. And we talked about him a little bit. You may remember some of the quotes. I don't think that this is true, but he was regarded so highly, they said, the glory of the law departed when Gamaliel died. Well, that probably was a big stretch, but it does give you some idea as far as how highly esteemed he was among the people. And excuse me, when you look at the Pharisees, this is a really important sect of the Jews when it comes to New Testament teaching. You find them in Matthew through Acts, and then, of course, you have Paul's reference over in Philippians, and that's going to be it. But they are a critical part of the life of Christ. And we've never, as a class, looked at the Pharisees. There are probably about 100 references to them. I've summed this up with about a third of them that I think will give you the primary pieces of information about them. When you look at the word that is translated Pharisee, people have different ideas what that means. Generally, I think the most accepted idea is that it means separate one. The Pharisees saw themselves as separate. Now let's, in view of that, pick up with that first passage, 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 17.
Okay, therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you.
Okay, is separation a bad thing?
No.
In fact, as you look at 2 Corinthians 6:17, God says you have to be separate. So there is a sense in which separation is absolutely right. If it's possible for separation to be right, is it also possible, under certain circumstances, for separation to be wrong?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Where would you think the wrong kind of separation would occur?
Here, in our family, church family.
Okay. If we're thinking about some kind of internal strife or division, especially if we're not dealing with a doctrinal matter, somebody doesn't like the color of the carpet or something else that is a matter that is somewhat arbitrary, or it's a matter that's not based on truth, then certainly that's certainly not going to be the right kind of separation. Yes. So, church family, where else? Bad separations.
Family.
All right, it could be the physical family. There are some things that come up that are more in the category of personal preference. People get their feelings hurt, and then you have bad feelings for years that keep people separated. So that's another good illustration.
Divorce.
All right, that's going to be another one. Again, people feel like they just have... people feel like they've grown out of love and grown apart, so they get a divorce. Stan?
Well, I think Betty just mentioned that separation from God.
Okay, sure. That's obviously a bad thing. You don't want that. So separation, a lot of different aspects to that. But when you think about the Pharisees, they were the separated ones. What do you think is meant by that before we start getting too far into the passages? They were the separate ones.
That's ones that disagreed with what's being taught or what the Bible teaches.
Well, there was that. There was that.
Okay.
Yes. You see that today sometimes. You hear people talk about the laity and the clergy. And if you have somebody that makes that distinction, where does the laity rate in respect to the clergy?
Below it.
Below it. The clergy, they're up here, so to speak, and the laity, well, you know, you're a lay member. You know, you're one of the guys in the pews. And you just don't count as much as we do. We see that, and in some respects, the Pharisees were a bit like that as well. They paraded around. And Jesus makes it very clear, the New Testament makes it very clear, that for the most part, they were not righteous people. They were known for their strictness. They were known for their legalism. And sometimes you see that reflected as people talk about individuals today. They will say, you are a Pharisee, or you have a Pharisaical spirit. Well, there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is found in the background of what these people were like, how these people acted, and the different items that you find associated with their lives, right?
Was the Pharisees sect as big as the Sadducees? Or are they kind of equal on it? I know the Sadducees are more in power here at this time.
I've never seen any numbers that I recall as far as the Sadducees. Josephus, there's a reference. I didn't include the Josephus reference. But back there, close to the time of Christ, he puts the number of Pharisees at about 6,000. I've always leaned towards the idea that the Pharisees were the larger group. But again, I've not seen any numbers as far as the Sadducees, how many they were. But the Sadducees were more of the aristocrats. And generally, as you think about a society, you have fewer rather than more aristocrats. So I think that also would lend some credibility to the fact that the Pharisees were the ones who were the more numerous back there during the first century. So that's going to be the direction that I would take us in that regard. Anybody else? Okay, let's move down a little further on a sheet. When you think about the Pharisees, they'd been around for a long, long time. If you need a copy of the sheet, we still have some at the back. Many would trace them back to the time of Ezra, around the 4th to 5th century B.C. So by the time Jesus shows up, by the time the apostles are working, they've been around for about 500 years. Now, when somebody or a group has been around for 500 years, that gives you a pretty good history as far as several years of able to entrench yourself in the lives of people, a lot of time for something to become fairly established, and that was certainly true. When you look at the life of Christ, especially what Jesus has to say about these fellas, as you have on the sheet, Pharisee is almost synonymous with the word hypocrite. Now that's pretty shocking, because these guys are supposed to be the very religious people. These are the people who are supposed to be very influential. These are the fellas who should be leading the way. And yet they are hypocritical in many, many ways. Betty?
Did they come out of the Levitical priesthood?
I'm not sure how strong the connection would be between them and the Levitical priesthood. Maybe one of the things people, if they want to be important today, sometimes you'll see that they will wear specialized clothing. For example, if you look at some dictators in other countries, what do you find oftentimes as far as a dress? Yes, but not only they're dressed differently, but what would that different dress involve?
Gold color.
Yes, it's gold. Maybe the guy dresses up in a military uniform. You see the gold bracelets, and maybe he's got some stars and various echelons, and you have some kind of flowing fabric, or there are some braids. There's something there to say, I am special. Now, maybe they kind of got that from the priesthood a little bit, that these guys have some special clothing. We'll adopt some of that. I don't know that we can for sure nail down some of those details, but they certainly did go in big for the fancy clothing, and that reinforced the hypocrisy. Anybody else? Okay, let's move down a little further on our sheet. The Pharisees often antagonize Jesus. Now, I find that to be interesting for a couple of reasons. If you're going to go out and tangle with the Lord, now remember, he's teaching for about how long? Teaching, preaching, healing?
About 3.5 years.
After you've tangled with this guy a couple times, you've seen him maybe, or you've heard him raise his dead and cure the blind and so forth, anybody with any sense should have done what? Yeah. You know, he's not somebody to mess with. We've tried to oppose his teaching. That didn't go very well. And if he's raising the dead and doing these other things, he's probably not somebody we're going to have much success in trying to oppose. And as you look at Acts 5, the people there should have had that same degree of sense. But sometimes people just don't have enough horse sense to leave things alone. So these guys, they go out and they antagonize Jesus. And we'll see this antagonizing behavior as we go through the list of references as well. You find that they are mentioned about 100 times in the New Testament, 98 in some translations, and we do learn much about them. Let's pick up with Matthew 23:2, Acts 26:5, and Mark chapter 7, verses 1 through 4. You have a minute to get to each reference. Carol?
The Pharisees knew they were outnumbered and everything, but it's kind of like a cornered animal. They could be outnumbered, but not outnumbered,
yeah, and they still will fight like the Dickens. Yeah, they will. And you have to, again, remember they have about 500 years of history. Jesus starts showing up and begins to chip away at what they have. And unless you're going to get on board with him, you've got, in their mind, surely too much to lose. So we're going to have to go out and engage him to the best degree that we can. Sometimes they partnered up with the Herodians, or they partner up with the Sadducees. Let's get on board with our enemies, because Jesus is going to be our common opponent. And that was the attitude that they had. So it really was difficult for these fellows when Jesus comes along and starts to pronounce the woes and really undo a lot of what they had done over the centuries.
It appears to me also that perhaps Jesus was deliberately trying to antagonize them.
Yeah.
Because one of the fundamental problems was they were making laws up that were not, they were their laws, not God's laws. And appears to me, for example, Jesus is healing on the Sabbath or doing things on the Sabbath. It was sort of like poking his finger in their eye to let them know. So that could have caused agitated that friction there because of what Jesus was doing back to them, in effect, too.
Yeah, exactly. If I don't know if you saw the news or not this morning. It was maybe an earlier morning for most, but Amazon is now getting into the grocery business. Now, do you think Amazon and the grocery business, they're concerned about Bill's and Jack's grocery store over there on corners A and B in our city? No. Who's Amazon interested in? If you're going to get into the grocery store business, who are you going to go after? Yeah, Walmart, Kroger. You're going to go after the big ones. Same principle with Jesus. You're not going to be concerned. I mean, well, you are concerned, but it's not going to help you that much if you go after the people who don't have much of a reputation. But if you've got 6,000 of these guys who have been leading the people for about five centuries, you're exactly right. Let's go after these guys. And you have heavy hitters on both sides of the fence coming after you. And that had to be very interesting. Entertaining, maybe, for some people to watch. It's, hey, Jesus against some of the Pharisees. Who's going to win this battle? They both have a lot on the line, and the Pharisees were certainly not going to take a lot of that stuff lying down. So, yes, that's an important point to make. Stan?
Well, the Pharisees were very arrogant also, and whenever you have an attitude of arrogance, sometimes you can come up against something that is far more powerful than you are, but in your mind, there's no way anybody can overcome you. We find that today very frequently, especially in politics. Some people feel that they are so important and so above everybody else that it doesn't matter how bad whatever they're doing is. That's too bad. We're bigger than you are.
Yeah, and we're going to squash you.
Right.
And likely that was the attitude of the Pharisees, at least for a while. And then Jesus finally got them by the tail and gave them a thrashing. All right, let's get our helpers here. Matthew 23:2. Who wants to head over there and be ready for it? Matthew 23. All right, Bonnie, we'll ask you for that. Let's take a look at Acts 26:5 after that, Betty. And then Lois, let's run you over to Mark 7:1-4. We go back to the influence of the Pharisees. Matthew 23:2. Many saw them as moral examples. Let's see what that second verse from Matthew 23 says. Okay, now here you have not only the Pharisees, but also the scribes, and sometimes the verses that we read today, you'll have more than one person. That's true here. But they sit in Moses' seat. We don't have all the details about Moses' seat, but we can probably infer a thing or two. What do you think about Moses' seat?
The law.
All right, place of authority. It was a place to teach, and it was a place of authoritative teaching. So when you come to Moses' seat and you teach, you are laying down the law. So when people looked at the Pharisees, they saw some people who were giving them not just a word. This just isn't a Bible class, but this is the law of God. They're going to tell you, you need to do this, 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 and this if you want to please God. And you better listen up, because we have the power behind us. We've got the people, we've got the history, and we are the people who have authority. So that's kind of a good passage to begin with. All right, let's take a look at passage number 2, Acts 26:5. Okay, now, isn't that interesting? Paul recognizes that there were various sects of the Jews. We know that to be true, don't we? Two of those would be the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and you could point to the Zealots and some others as well. But he says of the Pharisees, it was the strictest sect of the Jews. So when you look at the Pharisees, were they the liberals of the day? They would not have been the liberals of the day. They were the people who were kind of nitpicky. Somebody mentioned, maybe it was going back to Howard, remember the healings, or maybe that was Stan, the healings on the Sabbath day, sort of poking them in the eye. That was one of their little rules, you know, no work on the Sabbath day. And they had all kinds of rules as far as how far you could go on the Sabbath day, and you could do this, but you couldn't do that, and so forth. And it was very, very complex. It was a very cumbersome system that just weighed people down, and they weren't willing to lift a finger and help others. But Paul does recognize that fact that we were not liberals. We were a very, very strict sect. So as they were teaching from Moses' seat, Matthew 23:2, they really laid it on thick when it came to the various laws that people had to follow. Then let's take a look at Mark 7:1-4. If it had just been, how would you want to describe it? Basic laws about life. that probably would have been burdensome enough. But here's what we have according to Mark 7, verses 1 through 4. They also added on some additional things.
And the Pharisees and some of the scribes gathered together around him when they had come from Jerusalem and had seen that some of his disciples were eating their bread with impure hands, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they carefully wash their hands, thus observing the traditions of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they cleanse themselves. And there are many other things which they have received in order to observe, such as the washing of cups and pitchers and copper pots.
Great, and thank you. A couple quick points from that. Number one, most of us have been in a store. Maybe it was a restaurant. Maybe it was Lowe's or Menards, a home improvement store. You use the bathroom. And there, before you leave, you see the sign that says, do what? Employees must wash their hands. Now, if I'm getting a burger, if I'm in a restaurant, I appreciate that. With Lowe's, Menards, probably a little less important, but still, they do have that. Do you think that's the gist of Mark 7? Wash your hands before you go out and serve up the burgers? It's not for cleanliness, it is for ritualism. This is just that practice. There's nothing that is based on hygiene when it comes to the washing of that. And the same thing is true for the washing of the cups and saucers. Now, if I come over to your house and you're going to serve me up dinner, I'd probably prefer that you not just reuse those dishes that have been used a couple times and they haven't been cleansed. I'm probably going to stay a little healthier, and you will too. But these fellas, they also washed their cups, their saucers, their pitchers, and so forth, not because it was a matter of hygiene, but for rituals. So can you imagine somebody? We have people today who go through certain rituals, don't they? List a couple. People go through the little rituals sometimes.
Folding your towels.
All right, that's a good one, because I messed that up at home. Teresa, after 35 years of marriage, I still don't fold the towels correctly. So, I mean, they still work, and they still fit in the closet and everything, but I don't fold the towels correctly, okay? That's her little ritual. Anybody else have another one? Ray?
At night or morning when we get up, there's certain things we do before we start the day, whether it's take a shower, whether it's to take your medication, or make sure the coffee has been turned on, or whatever.
Yeah, put your glasses in a certain place, or prepare the coffee pot for the next day, whatever that might be. And you're not going to live or die based on those things, but those are customs, those are practices, those are rituals. Now, if your life is filled with those when it comes to religious observances, isn't that going to make life a little more difficult? You've got to do this, and you've got to do this, and you've got to do that, and it's kind of like, wow. You know, it's not just all the other laws that we were talking about as far as these are things in their minds that God wants you to do, but now you've got to add on all these religious rituals as well. Life really became burdensome. And remember that passage from Acts 26, verse 5? It wasn't that they were loose about these things. They were what kind of sect? They were the strictest sect of the Jews. So when they sat in Moses' seat and talked this stuff, it was, you can almost imagine the teaching. You better do this or you're going where? You're going to hell. So life under the Pharisees would not have been a pleasant experience based on what we've seen thus far. Now, somebody started to flash a hand. Who was it?
That was me.
That was you. Okay.
In our prayer life, talking about rituals and praying before we eat. Mm-hmm. But these are good rituals. It's not for the outside world necessarily
right.
to see, but it's our communication with God and our daily life.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with habits, especially if they're good habits.
It's good habits.
But these fellows were taking habits or rituals and saying, you've got to do this and this and this. And life really became burdensome. Anybody else before we go on to our next set of passages? Okay, let's move down a little further. Let's see what we've got in Matthew 3, verse 7, Matthew 9, verse 14, and Matthew 12, verse 14. Matthew 3, 7, who wants to take responsibility for that? Tina, thanks. Matthew chapter 9, verse 14. Matthew 9:14. All right, Jeff, and then we'll take a look a little later at Matthew chapter 12, verse 14. All right, Carol, Matthew 12, verse 14. Let's go back to point number 12. John the Baptist, he also was familiar with the Pharisees. So we get away from Jesus, we get away from the apostles, as far as Paul and Peter, and let's see what John the Baptist has to say about these guys. Matthew chapter 12, verse 14. Oh, I'm sorry, 3:7. I crossed out the wrong one.
But when he saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees coming to his baptism, he said to
I was out walking the other day. The lot next door to us is now being processed for a house they're putting up. And fellow was trying to locate the property stake. So I said, sure, I'll go back there and walk with you. So we're headed back there. And there is a snake that jumps out at us. Now, it's not a very big snake. It's between 2 and 3 feet long. Turns out to be a garter snake. I'm not fond of snakes either. And apparently that wasn't his favorite creature on the planet. So we both kind of stepped back. And he said, I love the outdoors, but not this part of it. And I said, well, I'm with you. So, you know, little garter snake, for a lot of people, that's not what they want to see, especially if it startles them. But a brood of snakes would be how many? You've got a lot. And I doubt that he was talking about garter snakes. So he says, you guys are a brood of snakes. What do you think he was saying by that imagery?
Vicious.
Yeah, vipers, which would be a poisonous snake. So we don't want anything to do with you guys. You are evil, wicked, corrupt, vile, nasty people. Now, can you imagine that? What have we said based on our study thus far? They were the really religious folks, right? They were the people who were very strict, the strictest sect of the Jews. And John says you are like a bunch of poisonous snakes. Now, John was not one really to mince words. But as he comes out and starts talking about these people, he makes it clear that they definitely were not, for the most part, good folks. There were some exceptions, but generally speaking, they were not good people. Anything before we look at Matthew 9, verse 14, Ray?
You know, somebody's speaking out against either the Sadducees, the high priest, the Pharisees. That would be a bad thing as far as their law, their strict law and things. So I'm surprised something like that. But it shows you to what extent the Pharisees really had gotten to. We can do the same thing with our government today.
Yeah.
Pick out certain ones that are just really horrible in the government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they certainly had some people that could have been on the wall of shame, so to speak. Not everybody was bad. Not everybody was as corrupt as some others, but for the most part, they had some serious, serious issues. All right, let's take a look at Matthew chapter 9, verse 14.
Then came to him the disciples of John, saying, why do we and the Pharisees fast off, but thy disciples fast not?
Okay, 2 points from that. Number one, what do we learn about the Pharisees? What religious activity were they involved with? They were involved with fasting. And not only were they involved with fasting, they fasted how often?
Often.
Frequently. It was a common occurrence. So if you were looking at that, you would think, well, here are these religious people. They fast, and they fast often, so they must be, in God's eyes, what kind of folks? Good, godly, great, uprighteous people. But we've already seen from Matthew 3, verse 7, they were like a brood of vipers, brood of snakes, poisonous snakes from John the Baptist. All right, let's take from point 14, that third passage that we read, we need to read Matthew 12, verse 14. All right, now this is a reference to Jesus. Now once again, not every Pharisee was on board with this, but there certainly were more than a few. What did they want to do? They wanted to go to Jesus and they wanted to
destroy
him. Not just get him out of the area for a little while, not just stop him from preaching, but they wanted to destroy, they wanted to kill Jesus. Now, when you look at people like the shooter that they had last week when it comes to the Congress, you know, some people have said that he was crazy. Well, you can debate that. But he certainly was not to the point where he was unable to think. When you can go out and you can plan, when you can plot, you have some mental competence. And that's what you find with these fellows as well. And the twist is they were supposed to be the religious leaders in some respects. They should be the people out there leading, showing, guiding people how to live. And this is what they want to do with the Son of God. So very, very twisted thinking. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up our next three passages? Carol?
They didn't just want to kill him. They wanted to destroy his teachings.
Yes. And the reason for that we touched on earlier, he's coming in and he's undoing everything that they stood for, hundreds of years of history. And it's all about ready to go down the drain if Jesus is allowed to do what he's seeking to do. And they were just like the Sanhedrin in Acts 5. They were more interested in holding on to that position and power rather than what was true and right. Anybody else?
But isn't that like today, holding on to their traditions?
Absolutely. There are some people in the religious realm as far as those that we would refer to as preachers or other individuals who have a leadership position. They might acknowledge that what we're saying is right and true, but there have been some who would say something like, I'd lose my following, I'd lose my job, I'd not have employment. Well, all those could be potential issues, but still, if you're going to teach error, and that's going to eternally condemn the soul, do you really want to hold on to that job? Don't you want to look at some other employment options rather than teach what's false and face God and say, not only did I teach error, but I knew that I was teaching error. I knew that I was promoting error. And I did that so I could, you know, keep an income coming in. I can't believe that anybody can think through that and believe that they're going to fare well with God at the end of time. Yet there have been people who have done that very thing. And it's not just in religion, but since that's on the same plateau that we're talking about now, that would be an appropriate illustration. That it? Okay, let's look at our next three passages. These are going to be Matthew 22:15, Matthew 12:38 and 39. So we'll get two helpers for those verses, and then also Matthew 15:12. Who wants to take care of Matthew 22:15? All right, Maxine, and then we'll take a look at Matthew 12:38 and 39. Don, and then Matthew 15:12. Matthew, all right, Betty, back to you. Thank you. Let's go back to Matthew 22:15. Let's see Pharisees, now on another occasion, what they wanted to do.
Then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk.
Okay, bad enough to destroy him, that's really bad. But here on another occasion, what do they want to do? Let's entangle him. Let's snare him in his talk. Are there people today who do that same kind of thing? Let's ensnare it. What comes to mind as far as an illustration?
Get you off subject.
Well, okay, there might be that.
Yeah.
Let's get him or her or them off subject. Gary?
Well, there's the people that don't want to believe what you believe, so they ask you a question to try to force you into an answer and then twist your words.
Mm-hmm. Twisting of words, that certainly has been done. Sometimes people will use words in a different way. So we see that in our time, sometimes with religion, sometimes not.
You mean that your idea of being saved is the only one, and I'm going to hell?
Yeah, or you're they might take that, and is that what you believe? And then they'll go out. We're dealing with that a little bit in Muscle and the Shovel.
Yeah.
Why, that's what those folks believe. Yeah. And then they'll go out trying to ensnare people in the talk. And that can create some problems. But yet, this is what's coming from these people who claim to be so religious, so godly, so influential. Ben?
Bernie Sanders the other day, when he was questioning one of the appointees. I mean,
Christian.
Yeah. Because he was a Christian, and he said, you mean all the Jews and the Muslims and was trying to ensnare him, and he handled it very well.
Yeah. Said, politicians on both sides of the aisle do that, especially when it comes to hearings.
Yeah.
They'll go back, maybe something from, well, this was from your college days, or you wrote a paper on this, or you wrote a book, and they'll go back and try to ensnare them in their words.
Yes.
So that's been going on for a long, long time in this country and in some other places. They're trying to do that to Jesus as well.
Entrapment.
Okay, let's take a look at that next reference. That's going to be Matthew 12:38 and 39.
Then some of the scribes and Pharisees said to him, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." But he answered and said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation prays for a sign, yet no sign will be given to it, but the sign of Jonah and the prophet."
Okay, once again, when you think about the words, you step back and you say, wow, did he really say that? You go up to a person and say, you're evil. Well, okay, that's not the nicest thing to say. And then you say, you are adulterous. Well, that steps things up a little bit more. But it's not just that you are an evil and adulterous person. He says, you are an evil and adulterous
generation.
It's not just you, but there are some other people of your generation. Going back to remember what Tina read, Matthew 3:7, you are a generation of snakes, vipers, poisonous people. So Jesus, when he starts to tangle with these people, he lays it on pretty thick, just like John the Baptist did. And then let's see from Matthew 15:12, what did some of Jesus' teaching do to these men?
Then his disciples came and said to him, "Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this saying?"
Yeah, you think that was a surprise to Jesus? You've offended some of the Pharisees. I don't think the Lord was too surprised. He knew that he was going to offend them, and he surely knew that he did offend them by his words. And they were offensive people. They needed to be put in their place. John the Baptist had done that a little bit. The Lord certainly did that, as we'll see from Matthew chapter 23. The apostles also tried to help bring them to the right point. But you do have people, I think Stan made this point earlier, as far as the big head. They just feel like, you know, we're it, and we're not going to back down. And they just needed some serious deflating. Before we take a look at Matthew 23, and anybody want to be headed over that way to be a reader? You'll read multiple verses as we give them to you. Matthew 23. All right, Jeff. Anybody want to add a comment or two before we have Jeff start reading from the 23rd chapter of Matthew? Okay. Jeff, when you're there, let's start with Matthew 23, verse 13.
But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, neither suffer ye them that are entering to go in.
Okay, thank you. There's a lot there. We'll ask you to read it one more time. We're going to break that down a little bit. But how does that verse begin? Jesus says, but woe. That doesn't sound good, does it? Anytime Jesus says woe to somebody, you know you're not going to have a good day. So he begins by saying woe. Let's go through that again, Jeff, and I'm just going to halt you as we go through various parts of it.
But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites.
There it is. As he talks about not only the Pharisees, but also the scribes here, he says, you are hypocrites. Anybody remember what the word hypocrite meant? No, that was Pharisee. Hypocrite.
A play actor.
Yes. When you look at where Jesus grew up, there was a city within about 20 miles. And it was a city, a large city, where a lot of construction was going on. And they also had plays there. Jesus is, if I remember correctly, and I'm pretty sure this is correct, Jesus is the only one in the New Testament who uses the word hypocrite. I find that to be a fascinating point to consider. And Jesus, and I'm almost 100% sure about this, is the only one in the New Testament to use the word hypocrite. Nobody else uses the word. And when you think where Jesus grows up, about 20 miles from where he grows up, there is this large city, booming city, and they have plays there. They have actors. And a lot of the acting was, you know, some pretty racy, some pretty foul stuff that we probably would put in the X category. You're probably on the R and certainly not the PG-13 category. But with that background, because Jesus is so close to that city growing up, he may have been very familiar with the word hypocrite, because there were actors there, people who were playing a part, so to speak. What was the part that the Pharisees and people like the scribes were playing? We're Mr. Spiritual. We're Mr. Religious. Our house is in order. And Jesus comes along and says what? It's all a sham. You guys are liars. You're like a bunch of vipers and snakes. You are religious hucksters. Now, if you're the average Jew, you think you might have been a little hesitant to take on these guys?
Yes.
6,000 of them? For the average preacher, that probably would have been a pretty hefty lift. But Jesus comes along, and even John the Baptist, and goes out and starts shaking the finger and says, we're going to expose you guys for what you are. So, again, back to the point that you made, you've got two very powerful forces conflicting, and there had to be some massive, massive sparks. So that's why you begin to see they took counsel how they could ensnare him in his words. They took counsel how they could destroy him. It was a very, very big deal. Don?
Yeah, ask us questions, even though Jesus called them hypocrites, and he knew. But all 6,000 of them, what they said, they believed they were lying.
Well, again, I don't know that we would want to say, because you have, for example, some good men like Nicodemus. So we wouldn't throw everybody into that category, but the majority seem to have been of the lifestyle that we're talking about. And obviously there's a scale there, just like when you think about Christians today. You sort of have everybody from 0 to 10, and I would think that the Pharisees could also be put on that kind of scale. But if 10 is the worst, you must have had quite a few that would have been in the 7 to 10 category as far as hypocrisy and doing some very, very bad things because of all the scathing rebukes.
Brad, I heard of, I apologize for talking to you, but I heard a definition that has stuck with me a long time about hypocrisy, of being a hypocrite. And the definition that I heard was a person that's not themselves on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's true. They were not themselves. They were this way as far as the corruption on the inside. And Matthew 23 is going to talk about the whited sepulcher. You look like a beautiful grave. And people might compliment that because of how the exterior looks, but inside we see the rottenness, the decay, the stench. And when you call somebody or you compare somebody to a rotten grave, yes, to a decaying body on the inside, and you say you look so pretty on the outside, that's pretty stiff. And yet Jesus, he comes out with some very strong illustrations to rebuke these guys on multiple levels.
Is there an application of this? Sometimes a brethren will become offended if a teacher or a preacher perhaps calls out some false teacher for something false that they're doing, and they give them the wrong reaction. They go after the person that's calling them out. Here we see Jesus is calling them out.
Yes.
So it's not wrong for a teacher or preacher.
No, I mean, he's laying it out about as clearly as it can be expressed. There is just no doubt. Now, done in a factual way, done as kindly as it can be done. You know, there's some things that are just difficult to say. For example, when the doc comes out and has to tell somebody your loved one died, there is no easy way to say that. Now, that's factually true, that information has to be conveyed. But there is no easy way to say that whoever was on the operating table, he, she, they're not going home. And you have that same problem in the spiritual realm. There are things that need to be said sometimes, and they are not the easiest items to convey, and yet still, if people are going to be fair and honest with God's word, if they're going to be right with God as far as being obedient to God, they're going to say those items in the best way that they can, but still, that is going to sting at times. Is that it? Don, you want to go back and revisit that again?
Is Jesus laying down a pattern for us as Christians? If we know and we have proof that somebody is a hypocrite in the church, or profess to be a Christian, are we to confront that person and point out why he's a hypocrite?
Well, let's take a look at Galatians. Let's go over to Galatians 6. Who wants to read for us Galatians 6, 1 and 2? Now, the word hypocrisy is not used there, but let's see if those verses can be related to the subject of hypocrisy. Terry, you have it?
I got it.
All right.
Brother, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you be tempted.
Okay, let's see if we can put the pieces together. What would you list as far as an example of hypocrisy on the part of a Christian in our day and time? Give me an example of hypocrisy. Christian is doing this but professing something else. Doing what's bad but is professing to live a righteous life.
Saying that it's wrong to steal when they're at work embezzling.
Okay. All right, let's say that we have a Christian who's working at a plant and they're taking things from a plant. Maybe they're bragging about it, but somehow we become aware of that. And in this case, we will assume or will affirm that the Christian is aware that stealing is wrong. All right, you have somebody doing that so he can, you know, build his tool shop out there in the backyard. Would we say that that's hypocrisy? All right. Now, Don's question is, should we respond to that? Should we do anything about that? Well, what would we say in relation to Galatians 6? Brethren, if a man be overtaken in what kind of trespass?
Any
trespass. Do you think hypocrisy would apply to any trespass? Yes. What does Paul say? You go and you do your best to
restore
such a one. Now, how do you want to restore the guy?
Gentleness.
And love.
You want to go out and rip him to pieces?
No.
Well, you may have to get a little rough with him, spiritually speaking, but Paul says don't begin there. Yeah. Begin how? In a spirit of weakness, or not weakness, but a spirit of meekness, gentleness, looking to thyself, lest thou also be tempted.
Right.
Bear ye one another's burdens, and thus fulfill the law of Christ. Now, who's going to be the spiritual person in a local congregation?
It should be all of us.
Well, ideally, it's going to be all of us. So, could it be an elder?
Yes.
Could it be multiple elders?
Could be.
Could it be the deacons?
Could
it be the song leader?
Could
it be a Christian woman?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it could be the guy's wife when she learns that that's how the tool shop is being funded, okay? Could it be a teenage Christian?
Yes.
Sure. So you have a lot of options there. But yes, if you do have that kind of activity in a congregation, Don, Galatians 6 would seem to me to be a very clear passage which says, we want to bring that guy back. Because when you look at hypocrisy, is the person pleasing God? No. And the ultimate goal is for people to go to heaven, right? So if you have somebody who's headed in the wrong direction, we want to see if we can turn them around and get them headed in the proper direction. It would be fun to say we've got a hypocrite squad. Give me the person's name and we'll go after him. Just watch your jaw drop. but you could say we've got a procedure intact for hypocrites. And if you'd like to let me know who that person is, we'll be glad to go ahead and follow up with him or her. To let that person know that that is not something that we believe is acceptable behavior. Now, the other problem there is sometimes you have, and you know this as well as I do, you have a person who sees someone who's a member of Congregation X, and they don't do everything that maybe the person thinks that they should do. Or they see a person sin once or twice. And their conclusion, based on that slip once or twice, is what?
Does it all the time.
Does it all the time, and he or she is a hypocrite. Because their standard for a Christian is what? In their mind, if you are a Christian, you're going to live a
perfect,
flawless, sinless life. Now, if that's the standard that they're looking for, and they see a person slip once or twice, and they say, aha, you're a hypocrite, well, then they are the ones that need to be instructed there, because they are the people who have the issue. And the problem there is not hypocrisy. The problem there is that the standard that you're imposing on that person, namely perfection, is not something that anybody is going to reach in this life, not anybody that is following that standard, not because we believe we shouldn't, but the Bible says, for all have sinned, past tense, Romans 3:23, and fall short, present tense, of God's glory, Romans 3, verse 23. So it kind of depends. But there are some cases where people would say, I'm not going to deal with him, or I'm not going to deal with them because it's a crooked business, or the person is always deceptive with me. Can't believe what the person says. So definitely there are times of hypocrisy. Sometimes the standard is wrong. Anne?
The thing is, the